Hey everybody, welcome to the Jeff Rubin Show. I am Jeff Rubin. Joining me on the Skype on my phone today is Colin Jones, the founder of Blackjack Apprenticeship. Colin has been counting cards for over 15 years. He ran a multi-million dollar blackjack team, and he has been featured in the documentary Holy Rollers, The True Story of Card Counting Christians. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Colin, when did you start playing blackjack? Like, when did it enter your life?
Yeah, so 2002-ish. I graduated with a college math degree, was working at Red Robin, and a friend actually at Bible camp of all places said, hey, you're a math guy, you might be interested in this. And he showed me a book on card counting. He said he was trying to teach himself how to count cards and wanted someone to get into it with him, and that's how I got started.
So you got into it not via, like, you didn't learn to play blackjack and get into blackjack and then think about how to win. You got into it via card counting.
Yeah, I know most people, they like gambling, or they start playing blackjack and then they lose some money. I was the opposite. I'd never been in a casino. I'd never gambled in my life. And someone showed me this book on it, and it made sense to me. It was pretty mathematically based book. And I was like, oh, I could do this. And I was looking for a way to kind of supplement what I was making substitute teaching, or before that, working at Red Robin.
Just very, very briefly, because we're going to talk about it in detail over the next hour or whatever. Very briefly, what is the basic theory of the case for card counting? Because I think people have heard of it, but they know it from movies or pop culture or whatever. Like, what is it really?
Yeah. So in its simplest form, it's just a way of keeping track of what kinds of cards have been dealt, because that determines what kind of cards remain to be dealt. It's what sets blackjack apart from every other game in a casino. Every other game is based on independent events, but at a blackjack table, if they deal a queen of clubs, that exact queen of clubs will not be dealt again until they shuffle. And so it creates dependent events, which is basically the composition of the cards being dealt.
What are, like, some common misconceptions people have about card counting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I meet someone and, you know, they ask what I do and I explain, in its simplest form, I say it's not illegal. It's perfectly legal to use your brain. Secondly, you're not going to, you know, get roughed up or get pistol whipped by surveillance or, you know, security in the bowels of a casino. And third is, you don't have to be a genius to do it. I'm not that smart. You just have to practice really hard.
You know, I was watching the videos on your site, and in one of them you mentioned that it is not a get-rich-quick scheme. Is that right?
Yeah, that's another one. When, you know, people either think, well, it doesn't really work, or if the people that do think it works, it's like, oh, well, why don't you just go to the casino with $10 and walk out with $1,000? It's like, no, it doesn't work like that at all.
Well, yeah, okay, so explain that. So if it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, presumably I can get rich eventually, right? Like, why yeah. Can't I walk out? Take $10 and turn it into $1,000 every single day at the casino. Like, what makes it a get rich slow, or maybe not even a get rich?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with perfect card counting, you have about a 1-2% advantage. So, you know, that it's a small margin that does add up. You know, if you have enough money to bet, you, like, for my career, I averaged over $400 an hour, but with that $400 an hour came, you know, plenty of losses as well as wins. And so a card counter is going to lose on average about 45% of the time, and then break even some percentage of the time, and then win enough, you know, where you're making a profit. But, you know, it's much closer to day trading or something where you're going to have wins and losses, but you look at the trajectory, you know, you look back after enough period of time, and it's going to work out, but with all sorts of ups and downs along the way.
So when you say you make $400 an hour, you don't mean that every hour you spent at the casino, you made $400. Mm-hmm. You mean over the entire career, if you take, like, there were hours where you lost a ton of money, but over your entire career, you made about $400 an hour.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I had nights where I lost $30,000, $10,000, whatever. And then nights where I won, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, even $40,000. You average it all up after the end of my career, and it worked out to $400 an hour. But some people think it's kind of like clocking in and clocking out at a job. You know, you walk in, you clock in, you walk out, clock out with a profit. It doesn't work like that at all. It's much more like an investment.
So yeah, you've really got to be committed to it, I guess, to make it work.
Yes, which is, I think, why a lot of people don't stick with it. They don't practice enough to be perfect. And even if they do, they get worn out either by the what we call variance, but the swings of the game, or they get burned out by the casinos kicking you out or asking you to leave because they don't like winning players.
Did you treat this like a job? It sounds like you must have had some log of how much time you were spending to make this like final determination of your career winnings, right? Like, was this, once you got into this, did this become your full-time job? Sorry, Red Robin, but did this become your full-time job?
Yeah. So I'd actually quit Red Robin a little bit before this, and then I knew I needed to get a job because I'd just gotten married. My wife and I, we had no jobs, but we had some savings, and she got a day job, and I didn't want to go back to working nights at Red Robin, so I got a job substitute teaching, and I was making between $90 and like $105 a day to basically babysit junior high and high school kids, and I hated it, and it was not, you know, really a long-term strategy. And so I convinced my wife to try this card counting thing on the days I didn't get called to substitute teach. And she, you know, humored the idea and said, go for it. And it started working. And at first, you know, I'm making $5 or $10 an hour. And then a couple months in, as me and the guy I got into it with, as we were able to bet more, we're able to make more money. And, you know, 6 months in, we're making $100 an hour. And I had no idea that we could make that kind of money. I thought maybe if I could make $20 an hour, that'd be amazing. But it really scales, you know, when you have quite a bit of capital to play with. And it just kind of felt like this guy was the limit. So it was a lot of fun. So we played a lot, you know, we started flying around the country playing. And, you know, after a couple of years, that's when we started training others to play for us. But yeah, very much treat it like a job. You know, the nice thing was it was a job where I could decide if or when I wanted to work or when I didn't want to work. But yeah, I took it very seriously.
Did you ever consider day trading or something like that, which seems like I don't know, maybe similar to counting cards in that you can kind of use math to look for statistical advantages and that sort of thing, just like a more traditional way of kind of applying math to look for statistical advantages? Did you ever consider that, or was it always blackjack for you?
Yeah, there's actually a guy that we were on, there were a few different iterations of teams I was a part of. And one iteration, there was a guy on the team, and he was very bright, and he was a little bit older than us, and he did both card counting and day trading. And so, you know, I talked to him quite a bit about it. What he said is card counting is simple compared to day trading. There's a lot fewer variables. The nice thing about day trading is you can do it, you know, in your pajamas from home, but there are a lot of variables outside your control. And, you know, I was more interested in pivoting from card counting into other kinds of businesses, or, you know, running a blackjack team was great because I understood it, I liked it, but I didn't have to be in the casinos. And then blackjack apprenticeship was kind of a natural progression because I can use the skill set I have and train others to do it. And so I never became a day trader, but I definitely considered it.
And while you're putting in your hours at the office, where do you live, by the way? Like, did you have a casino nearby that you could, you know, drop in and do this anytime?
Yeah, so we're really lucky, I feel like, when we got into it. I'm in the Seattle area, and there's, you know, quite a few tribal casinos, but there's also a lot of these little mom-and-pop casinos. And 15 years ago, they didn't, you know a card counter that was sitting right in front of them being blatant about it. And so it was really easy to play 20, 30 hours a week, you know, as much as I wanted to at any number of casinos until we eventually, you know, started wearing out our welcome.
And one of the things you mentioned in the videos is there's this percentage of risk of ruin, right? Like, what can you explain what the concept of risk of ruin is?
Yeah. So think of it this way. If let's say you have $100 and with card counting, you can have a 1% to 2% advantage. Well, if you put that $100 down on the table all on one bet, you have a 1% or 2% advantage, but you are nearly as likely to lose as you are to win. You know, maybe 49.5% chance of losing. Well, if you get that nearly 50% chance of losing on that one bet, you're out of money. You know, you're done. Well, that's how card counting works on a larger scale, which is that there's, like I said, all sorts of wins and losses, and you need to kind of bet in a way that could withstand any sort of, you know, luck in the short term, because the math is guaranteed in the long term, but, you know, anything could happen in the short term. So risk of ruin is like, what is, if you had 100 people that bet this way, what percentage of them would run out of money? So 1% risk of ruin would mean 1 out of 100 on average would run out of money. There, 99 would be okay. And that becomes really important when, you know, making several hundred dollars an hour, you know, you don't want to mess with being too risky with your betting, because I had no other way of putting together the kind of capital that I'd grown up or built up as a card counter.
And then there's one other concept I kind of want to make sure I understand before I proceed, which is deviation. So you talk a lot about like basic blackjack strategy. I mean, maybe people don't know, but like blackjack could actually, yeah, maybe we should do that. Like basic blackjack strategy, the game of blackjack, it's you versus the dealer. And every every turn, can you just explain what blackjack is? Maybe people don't know how blackjack works.
Yeah. So, and that's another thing people, you know, think, oh, you're one of those poker pros. I'm like, no, I'm, you know, an average poker player. I'm not a professional, but blackjack is very different than poker. Poker is you versus the other players. Blackjack is you versus the dealer, and the dealer has to make the same decisions every time, regardless of how you play your hand. And so that lends itself to a strategy that was worked up, you know, over 50 years ago, that's kind of the optimal way to play every hand of blackjack. It doesn't matter how the other players play. It doesn't, you know, matter who the dealer is. You just play this way. And that's called basic strategy. And some people call it the book. There's this thought that, oh, well, the book says to do this or that. Well, they're talking about basic strategy. It's the perfect way to play. But even if you play that way, the casino still has the advantage over you, because the casinos are smart and they built the game in a way that even a perfect player will lose. But card counting is going to tell you when the advantage actually shifts away from the casino to the player. So if you play perfectly and then you bet more at the times when you have the advantage and you bet less the times the casino has the advantage, then you can make money at this. And you mentioned deviations. That's kind of like another step on top of it, which is that basic strategy is the perfect way to play, except as the composition of, we call it the shoe, like it's like six or eight decks shuffled together, and they put it in this plastic kind of cartridge that's called a shoe. As the cards in the shoe, the composition changes. Like there's a lot of small cards, twos, threes, fours, fives, sixes left, or there's a lot of high cards like tens and aces left to be dealt. That changes the way you would want to play the game. It changes some of your playing decisions. So those are called deviations. And, you know, they're kind of a way to increase your advantage over the casino, is by learning when to change the way that you play, not by superstitions or hunches, but based on the math.
So you mentioned that 15 years ago at smaller casinos that, like, you could kind of, for lack of a better word, get away with this, and that, like, they weren't really looking for card counters, but now they are. I guess, like, what is the casino point of view on card counters? It sounds like it's not illegal, but if they think you're doing it, they're going to kick you out. But not, you know, take you into, like, a back room and break your legs like Joe Pesci style or anything like that. Is that all correct?
Yeah. If casinos lay a hand on you, you likely have a settlement. You know, I'm talking a six-figure settlement. So lawyer up if a casino were to, you know, force you into a back room or anything like that. As far as playing conditions, you know, here in Washington State, it's still pretty good. It's not as wonderful as it was 15 years ago, because our teams took a few million dollars out of the casinos here in Washington, as did other teams. But, you know, across the U.S., there are some places that are as good, if not better, than Washington State was 15 years ago. You know, I'm not going to mention them here on the podcast, but there are plenty of really good places to play. And there are more casinos than there were. So we didn't have very many options 15 right. years ago. Now there are casinos in, you know, something like 38 of the 50 states. And so it's a weird thing where one thing gets worse and then something else gets better, is kind of how it's been for the last 20 years.
And what is the setup that is your ideal setup? Like, what are the ideal conditions for you to be when you're walking into the casino?
That's a great question. I don't think I've been asked that on an interview before. It really comes down to a few things. One is the rules of the game. You know, every little rule difference at a blackjack table is either good for the player or bad for the player.
And blackjack's basically blackjack. It's not like anyone has like wild jokers in the mix, I think, right? So like, what are some rules that might, or do they have jokers? What are the rules that might be between casino and casino?
Yeah, there are some weird variations out there, but typically it'll be something small, like if you get a pair of aces and you split those aces, then you get dealt another ace, are you allowed to split again? It's this minor thing. Or if a dealer has a soft 17, which would be like an ace and a six, does the dealer stand or do they hit that hand? It's these minor things, but they all kind of add up.
And what are you looking for there? Do you want to be able to split with three aces, or do you want the dealer to stand? Like what's good for you?
Yeah, resplitting aces is good. Dealer standing on soft 17 is great. There's a rule that maybe 10% of casinos offer called surrender. And probably most gamblers, you know, use that rule very poorly, and it's to the casino's advantage, but we as card counters know how to use it to our advantage. Those are some of the good ones. But the other things that matter are going to be how much they cut off. So if they're dealing six decks, they're not going to deal to the last card. Typically they'll cut off a deck and a half. So that means they'll deal four and a half decks and then they'll decide to shuffle. Well, it's a huge difference if they cut off two decks and only deal four out of six decks, or if they cut off one deck and deal five full decks. That the difference between cutting off one or two decks is it's like a couple times multiple. So looking for that. And then the other is really going to be tolerance. Like how tolerant is the casino going to be? Are they going to, there are casinos out there that are kicking out players that are losing players just because they're so paranoid that someone might beat them. It's like if grocery stores were kicking out people that were using very many coupons because they're afraid of extreme couponers. They're just like freaking out, paranoid, throwing out anyone that looks like they could be a card counter. And I think probably kicking out a lot more wannabe card counters than legit ones. But as a card counter, if a casino is going to kick you out in 15 minutes, you can't really make any money there. Other casinos, you could play there, for months straight and they'll let you play. So those are probably the big three things: rules, what we call deck penetration, which is how much they deal before they shuffle, and then the tolerance of the casino.
I mean, it seems like they could nullify your advantage if they wanted to by using like 10 decks, right? Like,
yeah, 10 decks would be
like, it wouldn't be
pretty
hard
silly
for the dealer. It's not like there's like a technical limitation. So why don't they?
Well, it would be much easier. They could use continuous shuffle machines, which some casinos do.
Right.
But there's a couple, players don't really like those, especially here in America, where the reason blackjack became so popular is because it was discovered that it could be beaten. And we all want to feel like we're playing a game where we have a chance, casinos take away the possibility the game could be beaten, Americans tend to not like it. Some places like France, the players are just going to play crappy games. They don't care. But, we want a fair shake. So fortunately, casinos haven't done that. And people are asking me all the time, is that going to happen? And I say, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but it hasn't happened in, those machines have been around for 20 years and they haven't taken over blackjack.
They want you to think that you could beat it. I mean, you actually can, but they want like idiots like me to think that like I could beat the game, even though like I realistically don't have a chance.
Oh yeah, it's all part of their marketing. They put up pictures of winners, not losers, and they talk about how much you can win. They don't talk about the odds are that you're going to leave the casino with less money than you showed up with. They're brilliant at their marketing to all kind of give you false. It's the same as like the lottery. They're selling a false dream.
So surely you've been kicked out of a casino or two, right?
Oh, yeah, probably about 100.
How does that go down? What's getting kicked out of a casino like? I mean, it sounds like not a big deal, but I think most of us, I know I am never going to be in a position where I'm getting kicked out of a casino. So help me live vicariously through you for a moment.
Well, I'll say this. If you want to get kicked out of a casino, I'm happy to help you achieve that bucket list goal. But this is a thing. I think a lot of people have a lot of fear about this.
Well, it's like movies in Hollywood, And I guess maybe the casinos like this, that people perceive them this way. They want to be perceived as like this really tough place, even if it's not. So what's it really like? Like what goes down? There's not a giant guy that comes behind you, puts his hand on your shoulder.
No, that might happen. But what he's, I'd say 9 times out of 10, he's going to say something like, Mr. Rubin or Mr. Jones, your game is too good for us. You're welcome to play any other games, but no more blackjack. Or they say something like, we've evaluated your play. You've got a strong game. We're not going to be able to allow you to play any more blackjack. And then,
So it's like respectful. It's like, you know what? You're too good for us. So like, it's like, they frame it that way.
Well, what's funny is what they do even before that is they say, could you please step away from the table? Because they don't want the other gamblers to hear that they kick out strong players, you know. It's not good. It's not, you know, good PR to be like, hey, you know how to play well, therefore you're not allowed to play here. But yeah, that's what they normally say. And then there's the small percentage of the time where they're, you know, it's like, hey, you're done here. And if you come back, you know, or they'll say like, you're not welcome to play anything here in the casino. And then the smallest percentage is what's called a trespass, where they say, we have a right to arrest you for trespassing if you come back. And it's all just trying to threaten you because, you know, casinos are kind of slimy and want to intimidate anyone that has a chance of beating them. But I myself and the people I've played with and the people I train, you just got to take it with a grain of salt, you know, and don't let them intimidate you. They're basically saying you're not a sucker, you know? So I say, take it, you know, take it as a badge of honor and move on and go to the next place or come back to the same place 6 months later.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask is, do you use your name? I mean, again, this is like kind of like Hollywood legendy, but like, does your name then go in a book? Like, they hang your picture on a wall? I imagine like in Vegas at like a really big casino, they have some kind of, I don't know what, but sophisticated apparatus that would, you know, a blacklist they can maintain. But I can't imagine everyone can do that.
Yeah, there's a few different databases, casino databases, and you know, casinos can pay to subscribe to this. And it's really funny because I've known a few people that have gotten a little bit of a way in to some of these databases, and we'll look through them. And you know, half the people in there aren't winning players, but you know, casinos are dumb. So yeah, there's these databases.
I mean,
but
you got to be on their list because you're not even trying to hide. You have your blackjackapprentice.com, apprenticeship.com.
Yeah, I mean,
are you like allowed in casinos anymore? Like, surely they must be on to you at this point, right? Like, are you still able to do this?
Yeah, I can still play. Yeah,
great, cool.
it's that same thing of like, you know, don't take it too seriously. Just go in there, try to play, and if they say they don't want you to play, then go to the next place and play. And if they say they don't want you to play, go to the next place. But to be honest, you know, if you're not betting really large amounts of money, I can go to Vegas right now and I could play. I wouldn't use a player's card, but you know, I can play without much trouble.
So something we keep talking about here is like the teamwork. So help me understand, like, what is the team sport element to this? Is it about spreading out that risk and just like, it seems like it only works over time. And I guess if you have more people playing, you're just like, the more hands you play, the more likely you are to get the math into the right place. Is that correct? I think that might make sense. I think I hit on
yes.
That. Yeah.
So you're more right than most people are in thinking about it. I think that when people think of team play generally with card counting, they're thinking 21 the movie, where there's, you know, people behind or at different tables signaling other people, and it's all this you know, coordinated subterfuge. And we've done that, and that's fun. But the best reason to team up, the main reason we ever teamed up, was like you said, it's combining resources. You know, like if I've got $10,000 and you have $10,000, well, we can keep our risk a lot lower because combined we have $20,000. And then the other is, yeah, getting to the long run is what we call it. But, you know, if it takes, you know, it sometimes the math works out in 5 or 10 or 50 hours. Other times it takes a couple hundred hours for the math to work out. Well, if you and I can both put in hours, we're going to get to the long run a lot faster than on our own. And then honestly, like, camaraderie is huge. Just, you know, having someone else that is in it with you makes it a lot more enjoyable.
Is the movie 21, which I'm pretty sure I've never seen, but is the movie 21, is it in any way accurate or is it very Hollywood-y? Like, if someone was interested in card counting, do you think that's a good resource for them?
No. I mean, if you want to get, like, pumped up about the idea of being a card counter, you can watch it. It has enough right that it's not all wrong, but it has a lot wrong.
And then what about the other card counting movie I can think of, which is, of course, Rain Man?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's got even more wrong. That makes it seem like a, you know, more like a memorization technique or you know, it's not that. It's something that you just have to practice for a couple hundred hours and follow a system perfectly. But yeah, Rain Man's pretty far off from reality, but it's a fun movie.
All right, so back, I want to get back to the mechanics of how the team is organized. So then you guys, like, I mean, basically everyone puts money into the pot, and then everyone, I assume, at the end of the night puts their winnings into the pot, and then it's divided evenly? Is it that simple?
Not quite that simple, but kind of, that's in its simplest form. But we would, you know, let's say we start off and everybody puts their money into what we call the bankroll or the bank. Yeah, we throw our money together. We play for a certain amount of time. You know, it could be that, hey, we're going to play for a couple months, or it could be we're going to play till we've played X number of hours. We could say, let's play till we've made X amount of profit. That's the way that our larger team operated. We said, hey, let's play till we've collectively won $100,000. And sometimes that would take a week. Sometimes that would take 6 months. And once we had reached that goal, we'd split up, you know, all the profits. Everyone could decide what they want to do with the next bank or bankroll.
I mean, what are you looking for when you recruit people? It sounds like trustworthiness has got to be a big one, right?
Yeah, that's number one.
So how do you screen for that? Because, like, you need this person at the end of the night to accurately report their winnings just before anything else happens, right?
Yes. So that's why our team operated a bit differently than some of the other famous teams, because we kind of just stuck to our relational network. You know, if we knew someone that knew what we were doing and they said, hey, I'm interested, then we would, you know, train them. But even, you know, maybe that person would say, hey, my buddy wants to get in on this. Well, we'd spend enough time with the person, you know, maybe we start training them, but nothing's official till we're ready to hand them, you know, $100,000. And, you know, it's a tough thing. It's not like Starbucks where there's cameras, you know, watching the person at work, and you could see if your employees are taking money from the cash register. You just have to trust them. And, you know, we did the best we could. We had a couple not great experiences, but most of it was very, very positive. And, you know, it felt like a risk worth taking. I don't regret it, but, you know, at the end of the day, you just got to, you know, follow your gut and follow, you know, the data you have or what you're able to observe about a person, and hopefully have some relational equity where they know, hey, if they stole from the team, they're going to lose not just their employment, but their friends.
What do you look for? Like, what are the qualities of someone that would make you think, okay, this is going to be a great addition to the team? And I guess the other side of that coin is, like, are there any red flags you look for?
Yeah. So like you said, trustworthiness, that's number one. Someone could be brilliant. They could have all the right, you know, characteristics to make a successful card counter. But if you can't trust them, you just can't, you know, you can't work with them. You know, beyond that, it's like, do they have attention to detail? Do they have kind of the work ethic? And how do they handle conflict? Because there's, you know, it didn't feel like a lot of conflict to me. But that's because I don't really mind, you know? I didn't mind players at the table disliking me. I didn't mind casinos saying they didn't like me or dealers disliking me. To me, it just rolled off my back. Some people, and honestly, nobody likes losing, but it didn't emotionally impact me in a way where I couldn't do the job. It was, you know, I'd be bummed that I lost. I'd text someone on my team complaining about it, and then I'd go out the next day and I'd play some more. But some people really can't handle, you know, I guess the best way to put it is conflict affects their ability to perform. And if that's going to be the case, you're not going to make it as a card counter.
Now you've got this whole operation running. You've got a team. I'm just wondering, like, how you manage your time. Like, it can't be a 9-to-5 job, because I assume you go to casinos at night. Like, what? Yeah. How many, you know, is it like a 9-to-5 job in any way? Like, what is it? How many hours are you putting into it? Like, and how do you decide that, you know?
Yeah, it's really different from a 9-to-5. As far as hours, you know, we considered full time to be 40 to 80 hours a month, not a week, at higher limits, you know, once we were playing higher stakes. And one of the things that's different is for every hour playing, there might be an hour of travel or, you know, record keeping or whatever. Other ways it's different is you don't know how a casino is going to respond. You could walk into a casino and think that you're going to be playing for the next 6 hours. You show up and either the table conditions are poor, like they're cutting, you know, too many decks off, or the tables are crowded, or you could be asked to leave in 10 minutes. And then, you know, if there's no casino nearby, then you're done working for the night. So you have to be willing to be flexible with a lot of that stuff. When conditions are good, you just keep playing. When conditions are poor, you know, you got to move on or wait for the next day or whatever. But it does make it very different from a 9-to-5 that's predictable. You know, I think the predictability is why a lot of people hate the 9-to-5. But if you like predictability, don't become a card counter.
So when you start to teach people how to count cards, do you find that there's like other areas of their life where they see improvements?
Yeah. So I mentioned the idea of kind of where I start with people is kind of getting people to change the way they think. And a card counter doesn't think in terms of the short-term results, but in terms of what we call expected value. So the simplest example is flipping a coin. You know, if you flip a coin and you get heads twice in a row, you know, you might be like, hey, I'm a lucky heads flipper. And I'm thinking like, no, every flip of the coin is a 50-50 proposition. You know, the expected value of every flip of a coin is 50% heads, 50% tails. Whatever happens in the short term doesn't matter. That's the way a gambler thinks, is thinking about the short term. Well, that idea of expected value applies well beyond the blackjack table. You know, it applies to all sorts of financial decisions we make. I think it applies to how we use our time. You know, you've got the option to spend your time doing thing A or thing B. Well, what's going to have the better expected outcome over, you know, 1,000 trials of putting your time towards thing A or thing B? I think it applies to relationships. You know, there could be this kind of gambler mindset in a relationship of ignoring the relationship, and then like, hey, let's go on a vacation and save our marriage, rather than saying like, hey, how do I invest in this marriage in the small things day in and day out, and know that that's going to work out over the long haul? So I think that thinking in terms of expected value is a great framework that can apply to all, you know, I don't know about all areas of our life, but a lot of areas of our lives.
And then, I mean, do you ever have a problem? I mean, gambling's something you can be addicted to. Is that ever come up? Is that something you screen for? Is that, how does that work? Because like you can imagine, I mean, I can see this as being even more tempting to an addict, because it's different than regular gambling. Like, it's a system, right? But at some level, there's still some risk and you are gambling. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it can attract some gamblers because they're thinking, you know, they like the fix they get of gambling, and they're thinking, well, now I can do this in a way that wins. But generally, you know, gambling, it's like a dopamine rush that comes from the unpredictability. And with card counting, one, it's a lot of work. Two, it's not very fun once you know exactly what you're supposed to do 100% of the time. And if you're doing it properly, you know, I don't think you're going to get the same rush that a gambler gets. But I mean, with running Blackjack Apprenticeship, honestly, I feel like I spend as much energy, you know, kind of trying to talk people out of it as much as talk people into it. You know, if people are thinking they're going to get rich off of it real quickly, or if someone's like, hey, I love gambling, and, you know, or there's just a lot of like gambler mindset that you have to correct, or I'll flat out tell people, hey, you should never be in a casino again. You know, if you're using blackjack or gambling or card counting as a drug, you know, it's just not for you. Card counting tends to attract, there's those people it attracts, but the other group it attracts are people like me that are mathematically minded, a little bit punk rock, like a little, you know, anti-establishment, but kind of like nerdy, mathy, anti-establishment rather than, you know, kind of artsy punk rock.
Right. Do you at all, you keep talking about like it's work and you got to put in all this work. Do you in any way still enjoy the game of blackjack?
Oh yeah, totally.
So I mean, yeah. Does it feel like work, I guess? Or does it feel like you're having fun playing a game at a casino?
Both.
I mean, you must be so automatic at like the counting piece of it. Like I imagine you're, stop me if this is wrong, but I imagine you're just like, it's not difficult for you to process the odds and consider all these deviations. Like you must be pretty good at it by now, right?
Yeah, I've played a lot of blackjack.
So that's like not stressing you out. So are you able to just like relax and kind of enjoy the ride?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. I just thought of this analogy, but if you were like a professional Tetris player, like maybe you enjoy Tetris, and there's an angle of it that's like, hey, this is fun. But there's also, if you're doing it, you know, hour after hour, you know, like, it's not all fun. It can feel like a job or a grind. So yeah, at the end of the day, it's a game, and it's pretty sweet to be able to like make good money beating a game. But it comes with all sorts of wins and losses, and you know, you get sore, like back gets sore at the table, or you just, you know, your brain gets a little bit fried or any of that stuff. But I, you know, so if people think it's just going to be like you're James Bond, you walk in there, you play for an hour and you walk out with $100,000. It's not that, you know, but I still think Card King's pretty awesome.
How long did it take you to learn how to teach this? Like, was there a learning curve for you in explaining the process to other people?
Yeah, and that's where Blackjack Apprenticeship was really, I don't know, I feel just kind of lucky to have the progression I had, which is, I said I got a math degree in college. It was a math degree with a teacher's credential. I thought I was going to teach math. And then I realized I did not want to be a teacher. I like teaching. I just, you know, I didn't want to be a high school or junior high teacher. It didn't sound appealing to me. But once we started training players for our team, I got to teach, but something I was interested in. And I got to do it in a way that I enjoyed. And then we ran this team and I trained, you know, probably 50 people over the course of 5 or 6 years. And so I got to refine my ability to teach and train. And then, you know, we start Blackjack Apprenticeship and it takes off. And then it's kind of refining that same skill set. So I don't know how many hours it took. It just, I've been teaching people how to count cards for 15 years.
And then, like, what is your teaching philosophy for teaching Blackjack? What did you figure out was the best way to explain it?
If I understand your question, I think it really starts with understanding what card counting is and what it isn't, and the difference between how we approach it, which is like an investor versus a gambler. When people get that paradigm shift, you know, it makes it a lot easier. And then it's just the mechanics of mastering basic strategy, learning how to keep the count, learning how to bet, learning the deviations, which, you know, I don't want to make it sound easy. That takes a couple hundred hours to go from, you know, somebody that doesn't know how to play blackjack to being perfect at it. But, you know, it's a very systematic process.
And an interesting element of all this is that at least one of your teams was Christian themed, I want to say, like affiliated with Christianity. Like, how do I describe it?
I like that Christian theme. It's like the casinos are pirate themed,
right,
or whatever.
Yeah. Forgive me. I just don't know quite how to describe it. It was a Christian team. Is that right?
Well, no. The documentary was called The True Story of Card Kang Christians. So yeah, the guy that I started the team with, it was a guy I got into Card Kang with, and we met at Bible camp. And when this kind of larger team started, it was because we'd been a part of a couple other variations of teams, and then we kind of split off and we were doing our own thing. And then, you know, like a buddy from church asks, like, hey, you're doing that Card Kang thing, you know, can I get in on that? And we train them. Then someone else, like from, you know, a Bible study or whatever, asks us about it. And
so it's not intentional, it's just like these are the people you know.
Yeah. And it wasn't all the players were from our churches, you know, they weren't all Christians. But what happened is very early on, it was like the first couple of guys were people from our churches. And this guy that we'd used to be on a team with, we'll call him Sammy, he's like, what is this, the fucking church team? Because it was like people from our churches, and he thought it was an odd place to find people for our team. And we thought that was a funny, you know, name for it. So we just called it the church team, and it stuck.
It is kind of a funny place to find a lot of churchgoers.
Totally.
Mean, you've already mentioned that it's not cheating, which I think I can agree with, that it's, you know, you're just using your brain to play the game, and you've just prepared a little more to play the game than everyone else. So that's not cheating, mm-hmm. So that doesn't seem morally questionable to me at all. Remind me, I'm a little rusty, what does the Bible have to say about gambling? Is there anything about gambling in the Bible?
It doesn't say, like, thou shalt not gamble or anything like that. They actually, like, would gamble to make really important decisions throughout the Bible. It was called casting lots.
And
kind of the thought was, like, well, God's in control of how this is going to play out, or we just don't know, and so we're going to do this and trust the outcome. You know, so there's nothing negative about gambling. It's not, you know, the Bible talks a lot about money, you know, quite a bit. talks about a fool and his money will soon be parted. And it talks about the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. So people that love money, it results in all sorts, you know, which I think we can see in our own culture, you know. Mm-hmm. People that prioritize money exploit others. And I agree with all of those things, you know. To me, card counting is this hack. It's this shortcut. To me, it's like a mix between chess and extreme couponing. It's this game of strategy that can be mastered, but it's because there's this hack that exists that, you know, 0.01% of the population uses to their advantage. And, you know, I see nothing wrong with doing that. If someone's doing it out of greed, well, that's not a good thing. If, you know, but I think there's this thought of, well, it's too easy, you know, that bothers people, or I don't know, like, would someone have a problem with a Christian being a doctor or a lawyer that made $100,000 a year? It'd be like, well, I guess not. It depends how they use that money and why they make that amount of money. And to me, card counting is kind of the same thing. It's like a shortcut and it's a means to an end that, you know, the only harm it does is to casinos if people are doing it in a healthy way. And I'm all for harming casinos.
Well, can you actually explain why is it okay to harm a casino? I mean, casinos are slimy businesses, yeah, or whatever, but, like, I don't know, some guy owns them. So, like, from a moral point of view, why is it okay to harm a casino?
Yeah. some guy owns them. That's a problem with most casinos, is that they're a corporation. A corporation isn't a person that owns them. And so,
yeah, to be clear, I've got no problem with you taking all the money in the world from casinos. I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've thought about this more deeply, so I'm just trying to understand the moral implications of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, more broadly than casinos, I think a lot of the problems with corporations is that there isn't an individual responsible for the decisions made. The people that are responsible are like a board that their goal is to maximize profits. And casinos do that by exploiting, you know. So there's all sorts of studies done on the impact on a city when a casino is built. That what they're going to say, the casino's going to say, hey, this is going to generate revenue. Tax revenue is going to provide jobs. And it does generate revenue, but primarily by basically exploiting the people in their city. And not just the people in their city, but there's a disproportionate of basically poor people that are exploited. It brings in addiction, and, you know, there's so many studies. Suicide levels go up, depression levels go up, and casinos do it by lying, you know, by saying, hey, come here and have some fun and get rich quickly. And, you know, the reality is that if there's also countless studies of casinos basically putting their marketing towards the most addicted. So they're going to fly you in, or they're going to give you free meals. They're going to do anything they can to keep people gambling as long as possible. They study the carpet. They study the sounds, the smells, and the atmosphere that keep people gambling as long as possible. And if gambling were a neutral thing, that'd be fine. But gambling is one of the most powerful forms of addiction. It's been shown that gambling is as powerful as of an addiction as hardcore drugs. So, you know, that's... And then casinos are going to lie about all of it. They're going to, you know, say like, no, we don't do this. And then, you know, reporters have to go in and say, oh yeah, this lady lost all of her money, went bankrupt. And then the casino sued her for money that she didn't have. So, yeah.
So let me give you a moral quandary, which, congratulations, please. I've done over 230 episodes of the show, and I'm pretty sure I haven't said that yet. Let's say I invent a device and it's like a contraption with like, it's an ace up my sleeve on like some sort of spring, you know, and it works. I'm getting mm-hmm. away with this for whatever reason, 'cause I'm a brilliant inventor. So I'm actually cheating. Like when you're card counting, you're still within the rules of the game, but I'm actually mm-hmm. cheating, but you know, I'm doing it to steal money from these evil casinos. Is that mm-hmm. a problem?
No, I don't believe in the ends justify the means. You know, well, if there's a greater good to do wrong, but to me, card counting is, you know, it's neutral. It's, you know, playing the game by the odds they offer. So I wouldn't feel okay, you know, doing something that would be deemed cheating. And there are even like forms of what we call advantage play where you can legally gain the advantage, but it feels a little, it doesn't feel like a fair fight. This feels like casinos are saying, hey, come play this game. And I say, all right, I'll come play this game. And I play it very well. I beat them at it. And, you know, I feel great about it.
Earlier, I just want to make sure I get this. Earlier, you mentioned that, you know, if someone cycles the deck earlier, you know, it's an order of magnitude worse, or it's some percentage worse. Like you seem to know the number. I don't know. How do you calculate that? Is that something you're still working on, is like the general overall theory, and like you're sitting down with, I don't even know, spreadsheets or something more advanced than spreadsheets to figure out those odds? Or is that something that's sort of out there and people know it, and the question is how to, you know, just learning it and applying it?
Yeah, so those things are all done with betting software. There's, you know...
Ooh, tell me about... Oh, I got to know more about this. Tell me about betting software. What is betting software?
Well, yeah, so we you know, some people have created... We have our own that we've created, and that, you know, there's other people that have created it, and this stuff's been around for different forms of betting software for 15 years, but, you know, you kind of put in the number. It's all based on computer simulations, you know, that work out the math for us that says, hey, well, if these are the rules and this is how I bet and they cut off this many cards, then this is the expected value of what I do. And that's where I said, okay, well, you know, maybe for my career, my professional career, I was playing games that were worth $400 an hour of expected value. And I don't worry about if I win or lose any given day, week, or month. I just play based on what the betting software says and know that the math will work out over the long haul.
So you designed custom software to help you simulate, I guess, thousands, millions, I don't know, hands of blackjack to sort of help you determine the odds for things and kind of help generate what the correct answer is for various situations. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, our software is newer, but, you know, this stuff's been around. That was kind of a game changer for me.
You didn't invent the idea of betting software, but you did implement a custom piece of betting software that you built. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And when we stumbled across betting software, I don't know about stumbled across, but when we, like, forked out the $100 for some betting software, you know, a few months into our blackjack careers, that's when it really opened my eyes to say, oh, wow, if we look for these rules, you know, these situations and have this amount of capital, we can bet like this and, you know, not expect to make $20 an hour, but make $200 an hour or $400 an hour.
Very cool. That's so fun. Okay, so let's talk about blackjack apprenticeship. Like, what made you go from teaching teams and sort of running teams and people you actually know to, like, opening this website and sort of opening your doors to the world? What inspired that?
Oh, it wasn't my idea. I feel fortunate that I've ended up here, but it was the guy that I started playing blackjack with. His name's Ben. He and another guy that was on our team, they had this idea of like, hey, well, our training's actually pretty good. What if we, you know, put it on the internet behind a paywall and we'll put some free videos on YouTube and, you know, maybe people would want to pay for our training. And those guys kind of got bored with it. And I, you know, they asked if I wanted to be the third person to do it because I was running the team with Ben. I had a lot of experience training people, and I'm kind of the math or numbers guy. And, you know, when they kind of got sick of it, I started getting more excited about it and really kind of took the ball from there. And it's grown, you know, for 10 years now. And we've got quite the community I'm proud of successful card counters and really kind of fun, cool people. We've got, you know, a training course, we've got training drills, we've got, you know, like I said, betting software and all sorts of stuff.
I think one of the neat ideas I saw was you guys have an app, which seemed like a great way to, like, practice. How does the app work?
Yeah, it's just a $5 iOS app, and, you know, you could say, I just want to work on basic strategy, and then you can play hands of blackjack, and if you're making mistakes, it'll correct you and say, hey, you should have done this. You can also, you know, practice just your card counting with it, or you could practice doing those two skills at once, and you can learn the deviations on it. You know, it's simple because it's on an iPhone. You know, it's pretty powerful for what it can do, but it can't do as much as, like, the training drills that come with our membership, because, you know, they can fit on a larger screen and they can track a lot more things. But, you know, I would have loved if this stuff was around when I was trying to learn or even run teams. I would have told people, hey, train on this for 100 hours.
Do you still practice, or is it, you just got it now?
Yeah, I don't practice card counting, no.
How often do you get out to the casino? And do you play anything besides blackjack when you're there? Do you, like, treat yourself to, I don't know, craps or whatever?
No, that's poor expected value to
right. So it's
gamble
not,
in
it's
the
really
casino.
It's really not about gambling. Like, it's really about this math for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the fun of implementing a winning system, knowing it's going to result in financial gain and that it comes at the casino's expense. Like, all of that is the fun part. But yeah, I don't play a lot, but you know, I get out there some, and I don't need to practice for, you know, I've played enough blackjack, I've trained enough people, I don't have to practice before I go out and play.
When you're running the team, when you were running the team and that was your main thing, how much of your time was spent on like team infrastructure versus like playing blackjack?
Me playing blackjack?
How much of your time is playing blackjack and how much of your time is recruiting people, training them? I don't know, figuring out the strategy, figuring out the overall plan, all these sorts of things.
Yeah, I once the team was growing, I spent very little time playing because my time was much better spent you know, training, running the numbers, putting together the bet spreads, you know, all the infrastructure. That's what both Ben that ran the team with me, he and I, we put our time into. What was it going to take to basically run a healthy business?
And are the people working for you, are they literally employees? Like, do they get like a 401k at the end? Not a 401k, what's the tax thing? W-4 at the end of the year?
A W-2?
W-2. We got there. We got there. Took a few tries. I proved I was an adult at the end.
Running the blackjack team, no, they were all independent contractors, you know, because they could play when they wanted, how much they wanted, how little they wanted, where they wanted to play, you know, so they were kind of, you know, these independent contractors that we train them up, we provide the money, and then they'd go out and play, you know, and we had guys that at the end of the day, they didn't play very much or make much money than other guys that made, you know, $1 million at this.
And then... now with Blackjack Apprenticeship, like, what do you see as the future for that?
Yeah, I mean, I love the community. So I think my time is split between providing the resources, like the software, you know, the tools that I think are valuable, and then just kind of fostering the community. And then, of course, you know, we do like live events in Vegas. We call them Blackjack Boot Camps with like 2-day trainings. And so do 3 or 4 of those a year. You know, that's kind of my vision. And then I have a book coming out. So I don't know if that's, you know, going to be a big part of the business, but I think it'll provide information that as the game has changed over the years and, you know, hopefully get the truth about card counting out there to a new generation.
I want to go back to something you mentioned way back at the beginning, which is just that like casinos are more aware of it now. Are there more card counters now? Like, has software or the internet or some other thing enabled there to, is this like more prevalent? I mean, it's still 0.1% or whatever, but like, did it used to be 0.05%?
Well, I think I meant here in Washington State, it was easier 15 years ago because, you know, over the years we've beat them pretty badly. Around the country, you know, it really depends on the state and, you know, the casino. I feel like it's just this constantly shifting thing where one casino gets worse and another casino gets better. And I think 5 years ago, I would have said, well, you know, it was easier when I was doing it. But then there are guys that have come through Blackjack Apprenticeship that are making more money than I ever made. So it's, you know, it's hard to say. And they're even finding other creative ways of extracting money from casinos, you know, once you get, you know, deeper into this world.
What, like an Ocean's 11 style heist? What are the other creatures?
No. All legal ways of, you know, other games can be beat in some different ways. But think of it this way. Any game that is built in a way that involves numbers and cards and odds, there are weaknesses, you know, a dealer could be sloppy. A casino can offer the odds improperly on accident. They could create a new game that they don't realize that there's a way to beat it, and it's happening every day. So I'm not really going to go into more detail than that, but just to say, whenever casinos are trying to extract money out of people, there's going to be smart, what I call advantage players that are going to find ways to beat the casinos in new ways.
Do you, as someone who has so thoroughly seems to have beaten the game of blackjack, if such a thing can be beaten, do you have any interest in, like, you know, maybe, I don't know, learning, you know, just trying to find an edge in another game just to kind of like get the feeling, like that rush of like learning the new thing again and starting over? Does that at all appeal to you?
Yeah, there have been a few. I would, Yeah. There have been a few things I've learned because it is fun to learn something new and to try a different approach. But most of it are things I can't really talk about.
Yeah, yeah. I get it. I got you. Fair enough. But it makes sense because for you, it sounds like the thing you keep talking about, it's not the money. It's not like the glamour or anything. It's kind of like the satisfaction of like beating the system. So I just imagine that you're like in always looking for new systems to try to find and beat.
I'll say that it's not the glamour. It's the satisfaction, and it is the money, and it is the, you know,
it is the money. Okay.
I mean, you know, I don't think I'd be flying around the country being up, you know, 14-hour shifts in a casino if there was no financial gain.
Okay, so how can people find you online, learn more about the system in detail?
Well, Blackjack Apprenticeship, there's a few ways. We have a YouTube channel that I put out weekly videos, and then blackjackapprenticeship.com. We have a free mini course that you can sign up for on Blackjack Apprenticeship that kind of walks you. It's a handful of videos that really walk you through what card counting is, what it isn't, how to think about it, the basics of how to do it. And I feel like that's the easiest way for someone to figure out if this is something worth their time and energy or not. And then, of course, I have a book coming out in the beginning of June that I'm really excited about. And so that'll be wherever books are sold and until it's not.
And what's that book called?
The 21st Century Card Counter.
The 21st century. What's different about the 21st century card counter as opposed to the 20th century card counter?
Yeah, so there's a lot of books that are how we got started that are great, but, you know, the game has changed a bit and how people learn has changed. You know, it's a combination of, there's some advice in some of the books I got started with that I don't recommend at all anymore. It's just because the game has changed a bit. But the other part is how people learn. You know, back then, if you wanted to learn something, you buy a book and it has to be comprehensive. Whereas now, what you really need is someone that's going to give you the best advice. Because you can Google card counting and you can go down a rabbit hole of information that half of it's going to be, actually probably 80% of it's going to be poor advice. So I wrote this to say, look, you know, if you want to learn basic strategy, you could find it on our website. But if you want to learn how to think and really the best advice to make, you know, six or seven figures as a card counter, that's what I put in the book. And I also put my favorite, my best stories and interviews with over 10 successful, you know, six and seven figure card counters.
Do you have time? Well, just like an outline. What's one of your best stories?
Oh, one of my best stories. Gosh.
That's a real cheat as an interviewer, by the way. I feel like I'm not supposed to just be like, what's your best story? But you kind of set me up, so I'm going to go with that.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite ones, and this is a little bit of a spoiler because I haven't shared this yet, but there's a time where me and this guy, Sammy, that I was on an earlier team with, we found this game and it was about a 3 or 4 hour drive from home. But every Monday they offer these rules that made the game very, very beatable. Like it was worth about $600 an hour. And so we'd drive out there every Monday and we took turns, you know, him driving or me driving. It was my turn to drive and we're driving and it's pitch black out on this long highway with no lights anywhere. And, you know, who knows what we're talking about. And all of a sudden I see this giant white object in the middle of the road that I thought was a cow because we're in the middle of nowhere. So I swerve to avoid it. I overcorrect, hit the median and my car rolls and we roll 1.5 times and then the car stops on its side. And, you know, I look to him, I say, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, are you okay? And I say, yeah. And I'm like, where's the money? Because he had a bag with $80,000 in it. And if we find the money, we climb out of the car, you know, me first and then him. I cut my hands on glass on the ground, hands are bleeding. And, you know, finally a highway patrol car shows up. And the object that I swerved to avoid was a plastic bag. Like the kind of bag that a king size mattress would be wrapped in. And just because of the wind, it was, you know, filled with air and was like the size of an entire lane on the 2-lane highway. And so Sammy would tease me for years about, you know, he'd see a plastic sandwich bag and be like, Colin, watch out. But we asked the highway patrolman, or he says, hey, do you guys need a ride somewhere? My car was totaled. And he said, you know, the accident wasn't your fault, but, you know, let me drop you off somewhere. And we said, could you take us to the casino? And we said, He's like, you really want to go to the casino? And we're like, well, that's where we were headed and someone can pick us up from there. So he drops us off at the casino. And I had one of my biggest wins ever that night. I won, you know, about $30,000. I totaled a $4,000 car, but won about $30,000 that night and then rode home with some card counting friends back to Seattle.
I never even considered that you would have just like a duffel bag of $80,000 cash. Like, was dealing with just that much cash? Like, do you guys report, I mean, just between you and me here, did you report that on your taxes? Like, just what are there logistical issues with just dealing with that much cash?
Between you and me, like, you're not going to put this on the podcast. But no, absolutely. You know, we passed an audit one year with flying colors. But yeah, logistical, it's not easy because people don't use large amounts of cash. And so it just looks like you're doing something fishy. Everything about card counting.
That's where the story with the cop was going.
No. He didn't know we had, you know, he didn't see our bag of cash. We're not doing anything illegal and we paid our taxes and all that stuff. And so it's fine.
We're not doing anything illegal and we paid our taxes. BlackjackApprenticeship.com, folks. Check it out. Colin, thank you so much. Very enlightening. Many things about blackjack card counting I've always been a little misinformed about. I feel like I've been set straight. Thank you so much for breaking it down for us.
Yeah, my pleasure. And real quick, before we're done, would you do something mischievous or slightly illegal to beat the casinos?
I probably would, but I'm not very religious. So, like, I wouldn't mind. I honestly...
The ends justify the means.
Yeah. I have no stomach for gambling. I really don't. So, like, I'm unlikely. I don't know. But so that's the only way I'm going to be in a casino, I think, is, like, if I have some scheme like that. I don't think I have the stomach to actually pull it off, but I guess I don't see much. I don't know. I guess, is stealing from casino a crime? Let's ask Danny Ocean, you know? The Ocean's 11 movies make me think that... I think sort of have the point of view that stealing from a casino is fun and okay, and like it's not the only movie like that. So I do think like in this country, like that's sort of an idea that like anything, like the casino's trying to do anything can to get over on you, and like you're allowed to do that right back at them.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, well, I think if you get away with it, you know, maybe you're happy in the end, but I think probably casinos have a lot of cameras in there, so I'd be careful.
Well, Colin, thank you again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was a HeadGum podcast.